A Girl of the Limberlost. Chapter 1. Wherein Elnora goes to high school and learns many lessons not found in her books. Elnora Comstock, have you lost your senses? Demanded the angry voice of Catherine Comstock while she glared at her daughter. Why mother? Faltered the girl. Don't you why mother me? Cried Mrs. Comstock. You know very well what I mean. You've given me no peace until you've had your way about this going to school business. I've fixed you good enough, and you're ready to start. But no child of mine walks the streets of Onabasha looking like a play actress woman. You wet your hair and comb it down modest and decent and then be off, for you'll have no time to find where you belong. Elnora gave one despairing glance at the white face, framed in a most becoming riot of reddish-brown hair, which she saw in the little kitchen mirror. Then she untied the narrow black ribbon, wet the comb and plastered the waving curls close to her head, bound them fast, pinned on the skimpy black hat and opened the back door. You've gone so plumb daffy you are forgetting your dinner, jeered her mother. I don't want anything to eat, replied Elnora. You'll take your dinner or you'll not go one step. Are you crazy? Walk almost 3 miles and no food from 6 in the morning until 6 at night. A pretty figure you'd cut if you had your way. And after I've gone and bought you this nice new pail and filled it a special to start on. Elnora came back with a face still whiter and picked up the lunch. Thank you, mother. Goodbye, she said. Mrs. Comstock did not reply. She watched the girl follow the long walk to the gate and go from sight on the road, in the bright sunshine of the first Monday of September. I bet a dollar she gets enough of it by night, commented Mrs. Comstock. Elnora walked by instinct, for her eyes were blinded with tears. She left the road where it turned south, at the corner of the Limberlost, climbed a snake fence and entered a path worn by her own feet. Dodging under willow and scrub oak branches she came at last to the faint outline of an old trail made in the days when the precious timber of the swamp was guarded by armed men. This path she followed until she reached a thick clump of bushes. From the debris in the end of a hollow log she took a key that unlocked the padlock of a large weather-beaten old box, inside of which lay several books, a butterfly apparatus, and a small cracked mirror. The walls were lined thickly with gaudy butterflies, dragonflies, and moths. She set up the mirror and once more pulling the ribbon from her hair, she shook the bright mass over her shoulders, tossing it dry in the sunshine. Then she straightened it, bound it loosely, and replaced her hat. She tugged vainly at the low brown calico collar and gazed despairingly at the generous length of the narrow skirt. She lifted it as she would have cut it if possible. That disclosed the heavy high leather shoes, at sight of which she seemed positively ill, and hastily dropped the skirt. She opened the pail, removed the lunch, wrapped it in the napkin, and placed it in a small pasteboard box. Locking the case again she hid the key and hurried down the trail. She followed it around the north end of the swamp and then entered a footpath crossing a farm leading in the direction of the spires of the city to the northeast. Again she climbed a fence and was on the open road. For an instant she leaned against the fence staring before her, then turned and looked back. Behind her lay the land on which she had been born to drudgery and a mother who made no pretense of loving her. Before her lay the city through whose schools she hoped to find means of escape and the way to reach the things for which she cared. When she thought of how she appeared she leaned more heavily against the fence and groaned. When she thought of turning back and wearing such clothing in ignorance all the days of her life she set her teeth firmly and went hastily toward Onabasha. On the bridge crossing a deep culvert at the suburbs she glanced around, and then kneeling she thrust the lunchbox between the foundation and the flooring. This left her empty-handed as she approached the big stone high school building. She entered bravely and inquired her way to the office of the superintendent. There she learned that she should have come the previous week and arranged about her classes. There were many things incident to the opening of school, and one man unable to cope with all of them. Where have you been attending school? He asked, while he advised the teacher of domestic science not to telephone for groceries until she knew how many she would have in her classes, wrote an order for chemicals for the students of science, and advised the leader of the orchestra to hire a professional to take the place of the bass violist. Reported suddenly ill. I finished last spring at Brushwood School, District No. 9, said Elnora. I have been studying all summer. I am quite sure I can do the first year work, if I have a few days to get started. Of course, assented the superintendent. Almost invariably country pupils do good work. You may enter first year, and if it is too difficult, we will find it out speedily. Your teachers will tell you the list of books you must have, and if you will come with me I will show you the way to the auditorium. It is now time for opening exercises. Take any seat you find vacant. Elnora stood before the entrance and stared into the largest room she ever had seen. The floor sloped to a yawning stage on which a band of musicians, grouped around a grand piano, were tuning their instruments. She had two fleeting impressions. That it was all a mistake, this was no school, but a grand display of enormous ribbon bows, and the second, that she was sinking, and had forgotten how to walk. Then a burst from the orchestra nerved her while a bevy of daintily clad, sweet-smelling things that might have been birds, or flowers, or possibly gaily dressed, happy young girls, pushed her forward. She found herself plodding across the back of the auditorium, praying for guidance, to an empty seat. As the girls passed her, vacancies seemed to open to meet them. Their friends were moving over, beckoning and whispering invitations. Everyone else was seated, but no one paid any attention to the white-faced girl stumbling half-blindly down the aisle next the farthest wall. So she went on to the very end facing the stage. No one moved, and she could not summon courage to crowd past others to several empty seats she saw. At the end of the aisle she paused in desperation, while she stared back at the whole forest of faces, most of which were now turned upon her. In a flash came the full realization of her scanty dress, her pitiful little hat and ribbon, her big, heavy shoes, her ignorance of where to go or what to do, and from a sickening wave which crept over her, she felt she was going to become very ill. Then out of the mass she saw a pair of big, brown boy eyes, three seats from her, and there was a message in them. Without moving his body he reached forward and with a pencil touched the back of the seat before him. Instantly Elnora took another step which brought her to a row of vacant front seats. She heard laughter behind her, the knowledge that she wore the only hat in the room burnt her, every matter of moment, and some of none at all, cut and stung. She had no books. Where should she go when this was over? What would she give to be on the trail going home? She was shaking with a nervous chill when the music ceased, and the superintendent arose, and coming down to the front of the flower-decked platform, opened a Bible and began to read. Elnora did not know what he was reading, and she felt that she did not care. Wildly she was racking her brain to decide whether she should sit still when the others left the room or follow, and ask someone where the freshman went first. In the midst of the struggle one sentence fell on her ear. "Hide me under the shadow of thy wings." Elnora began to pray frantically. "Hide me, O God, hide me, under the shadow of thy wings." Again and again she implored that prayer, and before she realized what was coming, everyone had arisen and the room was emptying rapidly. Elnora hurried after the nearest girl and in the press at the door touched her sleeve timidly. "Will you please tell me where the freshmen go?" she asked huskily. The girl gave her one surprised glance, and drew away. "Same place as the fresh women," she answered, and those nearest her laughed. Elnora stopped praying suddenly and the color crept into her face. "I'll wager you are the first person I meet when I find it," she said and stopped short. "Not that. Oh, I must not do that," she thought in dismay. "Make an enemy the first thing I do. Oh, not that." She followed with her eyes as the young people separated in the hall, some climbing stairs, some disappearing down side halls, some entering adjoining doors. She saw the girl overtake the brown-eyed boy and speak to him. He glanced back at Elnora with a scowl on his face. Then she stood alone in the hall. Presently a door opened and a young woman came out and entered another room. Elnora waited until she returned, and hurried to her. "Would you tell me where the freshmen are?" she panted. "Straight down the hall, three doors to your left," was the answer, as the girl passed. "One minute please, oh please," begged Elnora, "should I knock or just open the door?" "Go in and take a seat," replied the teacher. "What if there aren't any seats?" gasped Elnora. "Classrooms are never half-filled, there will be plenty," was the answer. Elnora removed her hat. There was no place to put it, so she carried it in her hand. She looked infinitely better without it. After several efforts she at last opened the door and stepping inside faced a smaller and more concentrated battery of eyes. "The superintendent sent me. He thinks I belong here," she said to the professor in charge of the class, but she never before heard the voice with which she spoke. As she stood waiting, the girl of the hall passed on her way to the blackboard, and suppressed laughter told Elnora that her thrust had been repeated. "Be seated," said the professor, and then because he saw Elnora was desperately embarrassed he proceeded to lend her a book and to ask her if she had studied algebra. She said she had a little, but not the same book they were using. He asked her if she felt that she could do the work they were beginning, and she said she did. That was how it happened, that 3 minutes after entering the room she was told to take her place beside the girl who had gone last to the board, and whose flushed face and angry eyes avoided meeting Eleanor's. Being compelled to concentrate on her proposition she forgot herself. When the professor asked that all pupils sign their work she firmly wrote Elnora Comstock under her demonstration. Then she took her seat and waited with white lips and trembling limbs, as one after another professor called the names on the board, while their owners arose and explained their propositions, or flunked if they had not found a correct solution. She was so eager to catch their forms of expression and prepare herself for her recitation, that she never looked from the work on the board, until clearly and distinctly, Elnora Cornstalk called the professor. The dazed girl stared at the board. One tiny curl added to the top of the first curve of the M in her name had transformed it from a good old English patronymic that any girl might bear proudly, to Cornstalk. Elnora sat speechless. When and how did it happen? She could feel the wave of smothered laughter in the air around her. A rush of anger turned her face scarlet and her soul sick. The voice of the professor addressed her directly. "This proposition seems to be beautifully demonstrated, Miss Cornstalk," he said. "Surely, you can tell us how you did it." That word of praise saved her. She could do good work. They might wear their pretty clothes, have their friends and make life a greater misery than it ever before had been for her, but not one of them should do better work or be more womanly. That lay with her. She was tall, straight, and handsome as she arose. "Of course I can explain my work," she said in natural tones. "What I can't explain is how I happened to be so stupid as to make a mistake in writing my own name. I must have been a little nervous. Please excuse me." She went to the board, swept off the signature with one stroke, then rewrote it plainly. "My name is Comstock," she said distinctly. She returned to her seat and, following the formula used by the others, made her first high school recitation. As Elnora resumed her seat, Professor Henley looked at her steadily. "It puzzles me," he said deliberately, "how you can write as beautiful a demonstration, and explain it as clearly as ever has been done in any of my classes, and still be so disturbed as to make a mistake in your own name. Are you very sure you did that yourself, Miss Comstock?" "It is impossible that anyone else should have done it," answered Elnora. "I am very glad you think so," said the professor. "Being freshmen, all of you are strangers to me. I should dislike to begin the year with you feeling there was one among you small enough to do a trick like that. The next proposition, please." When the hour had gone, the class filed back to the study room and Elnora followed in desperation, because she did not know where else to go. She could not study as she had no books, and when the class again left the room to go to another professor for the next recitation, she went also. At least they could put her out if she did not belong there. Noon came at last, and she kept with the others until they dispersed on the sidewalk. She was so abnormally self-conscious she fancied all the hundreds of that laughing throng saw and jested at her. When she passed the brown-eyed boy walking with the girl of her encounter, she knew, for she heard him say, "Did you really let that gawky piece of calico get ahead of you?" The answer was indistinct. Elnora hurried from the city. She intended to get her lunch, eat it in the shade of the first tree, and then decide whether she would go back or go home. She knelt on the bridge and reached for her box, but it was so very light that she was prepared for the fact that it was empty, before opening it. There was one thing for which to be thankful. The boy or tramp who had seen her hide it, had left the napkin. She would not have to face her mother and account for its loss. She put it in her pocket, and threw the box into the ditch. Then she sat on the bridge and tried to think, but her brain was confused. "Perhaps the worst is over," she said at last. "I will go back. What would mother say to me if I came home now?" So she returned to the high school, followed some other pupils to the coat room, hung her hat, and found her way to the study where she had been in the morning. Twice that afternoon, with aching head and empty stomach, she faced strange professors, in different branches. Once she escaped notice, the second time the worst happened. She was asked a question she could not answer. "Have you not decided on your course, and secured your books?" inquired the professor. "I have decided on my course," replied Elnora. "I do not know where to ask for my books." "Ask?" The professor was bewildered. "I understood the books were furnished," faltered Elnora. "Only to those bringing an order from the township trustee," replied the professor. "No. Oh no," cried Elnora. "I will have them tomorrow," and gripped her desk for support, for she knew that was not true. Four books, ranging perhaps at $1.50 apiece, would her mother buy them? Of course she would not, could not. Did not Elnora know the story of old? There was enough land, but no one to do clearing and farm. Tax on all those acres, recently the new gravel road tax added, the expense of living and only the work of two women to meet all of it. She was insane to think she could come to the city to school. Her mother had been right. The girl decided that if only she lived to reach home, she would stay there and lead any sort of life to avoid more of this torture. Bad as what she wished to escape had been, it was nothing like this. She never could live down the movement that went through the class when she inadvertently revealed the fact that she had expected books to be furnished. Her mother would not secure them, that settled the question. But the end of misery is never in a hurry to come. Before the day was over, the superintendent entered the room and explained that pupils from the country were charged a tuition of $20 a year. That really was the end. Previously, Eleonora had canvassed a dozen methods for securing the money for books, ranging all the way from offering to wash the superintendent's dishes to breaking into the bank. This additional expense made her plans so wildly impossible, there was nothing to do but hold up her head until she was from sight. Down the long corridor alone among hundreds, down the long street alone among thousands, out into the country she came at last. Across the fence and field, along the old trail once trodden by a boy's bitter agony, now stumbled a white-faced girl, sick at heart. She sat on a log and began to sob in spite of her efforts at self-control. At first it was physical breakdown, later, thought came crowding. Oh, the shame, the mortification. Why had she not known of the tuition? How did she happen to think that in the city books were furnished? Perhaps it was because she had read they were in several states. But why did she not know? Why did not her mother go with her? Other mothers. But when had her mother ever been or done anything at all like other mothers? Because she never had been, it was useless to blame her now. Eleonora realized she should have gone to town the week before, called on someone and learned all these things herself. She should have remembered how her clothing would look, before she wore it in public places. Now she knew, and her dreams were over. She must go home to feed chickens, calves, and pigs, wear calico and coarse shoes, and with averted head, pass a library all her life. She sobbed again. "For pity's sake, honey, what's the matter?" asked the voice of the nearest neighbor, Wesley Sinton, as he seated himself beside Eleonora. "There, there," he continued, smearing tears all over her face in an effort to dry them. "Was it as bad as that, now? Maggie has been just wild over you all day. She's got nervouser every minute. She said we were foolish to let you go. She said your clothes were not right, you ought not to carry that tin pail, and that they would laugh at you. By gum, I see they did." "Oh, Uncle Wesley," sobbed the girl, "why didn't she tell me?" "Well, you see, Eleonora, she didn't like to. You got such a way of holding up your head, and going through with things. She thought some way that you'd make it, till you got started, and then she begun to see 100 things we should have done. I reckon you hadn't reached that building before she remembered that your skirt should have been pleated instead of gathered, your shoes been low, and lighter for hot September weather, and a new hat. Were your clothes right, Eleonora?" The girl broke into hysterical laughter. "Right," she cried. "Right. Uncle Wesley, you should have seen me among them. I was a picture. They'll never forget me. No, they won't get the chance, for they'll see me again tomorrow. Now that is what I call spunk, Eleonora." "Downright grit," said Wesley Sinton. "Don't you let them laugh you out. You've helped Margaret and me for years at harvest and busy times, what you've earned must amount to quite a sum. You can get yourself a good many clothes with it."
"Don't mention clothes, Uncle Wesley," sobbed Eleonora, "I don't care now how I look. If I don't go back, all of them will know it's because I am so poor I can't buy my books."
"Oh, I don't know as you are so dratted poor," said Sinton meditatively. "There are 300 acres of good land, with fine timber as ever grew on it. It takes all we can earn to pay the tax, and mother wouldn't cut a tree for her life."
"Well then, maybe, I'll be compelled to cut one for her," suggested Sinton. "Anyway, stop tearing yourself to pieces and tell me. If it isn't clothes, what is it?"
"It's books and tuition. Over $20 in all."
"Humphrey. First time I ever knew you to be stumped by $20, Eleonora," said Sinton, patting her hand.
"It's the first time you ever knew me to want money," answered Eleonora. "This is different from anything that ever happened to me.
Oh, how can I get it, Uncle Wesley?"
"Drive to town with me in the morning and I'll draw it from the bank for you. I owe you every cent of it.
You know you don't owe me a penny, and I wouldn't touch one from you, unless I really could earn it. For anything that's past, I owe you and Aunt Margaret for all the home life and love I've ever known. I know how you work, and I'll not take your money.
Just a loan, Eleonora, just a loan for a little while until you can earn it. You can be proud with all the rest of the world, but there are no secrets between us, are there, Eleonora?"
"No," said Eleonora, "there are none. You and Aunt Margaret have given me all the love there has been in my life. That is the one reason above all others why you shall not give me charity. Hand me money because you find me crying for it. This isn't the first time this old trail has known tears and heartache. All of us know that story. Freckles stuck to what he undertook and won out.
I stick, too. When Duncan moved away he gave me all freckles left in the swamp, and as I have inherited his property maybe his luck will come with it. I won't touch your money, but I'll win some way. First, I'm going home and try mother. It's just possible I could find second-hand books, and perhaps all the tuition need not be paid at once. Maybe they would accept it quarterly. But oh, Uncle Wesley, you and Aunt Margaret keep on loving me. I'm soul only, and no one else cares. Wesley Sinton's jaws met with a click. He swallowed hard on bitter words and changed what he would have liked to say three times before it became articulate. Elnora, he said at last, if it hadn't been for one thing I'd have tried to take legal steps to make you ours when you were 3 years old. Maggie said then it wasn't any use, but I've always held on. You see, I was the first man there, honey, and there are things you see, that you can't ever make anybody else understand. She loved him, Elnora, she just made an idol of him. There was that oozy green hole, with the thick scum broke, and two or three big bubbles slowly rising that were the breath of his body. There she was in spasms of agony, and beside her the great heavy log she'd tried to throw him. I can't ever forgive her for turning against you, and spoiling your childhood as she has, but I couldn't forgive anybody else for abusing her. Maggie has got no mercy on her, but Maggie didn't see what I did, and I've never tried to make it very clear to her. It's been a little too plain for me ever since. Whenever I look at your mother's face, I see what she saw, so I hold my tongue and say, in my heart, give her a mite more time. Someday it will come. She does love you, Elnora. Everybody does, honey. It's just that she's feeling so much, she can't express herself. You be a patient girl and wait a little longer. After all, she's your mother, and you're all she's got, but a memory, and it might do her good to let her know that she was fooled in that. It would kill her, cried the girl swiftly. Uncle Wesley, it would kill her. What do you mean? Nothing, said Wesley Sinton soothingly. Nothing, honey. That was just one of them fool things a man says, when he is trying his best to be wise. You see, she loved him mightily, and they'd been married only a year, and what she was loving was what she thought he was. She hadn't really got acquainted with a man yet. If it had been even one more year, she could have borne it, and you'd have got justice. Having been a teacher she was better educated and smarter than the rest of us, and so she was more sensitive-like. She can't understand she was loving a dream. So I say it might do her good if somebody that knew, could tell her. But I swear to gracious, I never could. I've heard her out at the edge of that quagmire calling in them wild spells of hers off and on for the last 16 years, and imploring the swamp to give him back to her, and I've got out of bed when I was pretty tired, and come down to see she didn't go in herself, or harm you. What she feels is too deep for me. I've got to respect in her grief, and I can't get over it. Go home and tell your ma, honey, and ask her nice and kind to help you. If she won't, then you got to swallow that little lump of pride in your neck, and come to Aunt Maggie, like you've been a-coming all your life. I'll ask Mother, but I can't take your money, Uncle Wesley, indeed I can't. I'll wait a year, and earn some, and enter next year. There's one thing you don't consider, Elnora, said the man earnestly. And that's what you are to Maggie. She's a little like your ma. She hasn't given up to it, and she's struggling on brave, but when we buried our second little girl the light went out of Maggie's eyes, and it's not come back. The only time I ever see a hint of it is when she thinks she's done something that makes you happy, Elnora. Now, you go easy about refusing her anything she wants to do for you. There's times in this world when it's our bounden duty to forget ourselves, and think what will help other people. Young woman, you owe me and Maggie all the comfort we can get out of you. There's the two of our own we can't ever do anything for. Don't you get the idea into your head that a fool thing you call pride is going to cut us out of all the pleasure we have in life beside ourselves? Uncle Wesley, you are a dear, said Elnora. Just a dear. If I can't possibly get that money any way else on earth, I'll come and borrow it of you, and then I'll pay it back if I must dig ferns from the swamp and sell them from door to door in the city. I'll even plant them, so that they will be sure to come up in the spring. I have been sort of panic-stricken all day and couldn't think. I can gather nuts and sell them. Freckles sold moths and butterflies, and I've a lot collected. Of course, I am going back tomorrow. I can find a way to get the books. Don't you worry about me. I am all right. Now, what do you think of that? Inquired Wesley Sinton of the swamp in general. Here's our Elnora come back to stay. Head high and right as a trivet. You've named 3 ways in 3 minutes that you could earn $10, which I figure would be enough, to start you. Let's go to supper and stop worrying. Elnora unlocked the case, took out the pail, put the napkin in it, pulled the ribbon from her hair, binding it down tightly again and followed to the road.
From afar she could see her mother in the doorway. She blinked her eyes, and tried to smile as she answered Wesley Sinton, and indeed she did feel better. She knew now what she had to expect, where to go, and what to do. Get the books she must, when she had them. She would show those city girls and boys how to prepare and recite lessons, how to walk with a brave heart, and they could show her how to wear pretty clothes and have good times. As she neared the door her mother reached for the pail. "I forgot to tell you to bring home your scraps for the chickens," she said. Elnora entered. "There weren't any scraps, and I'm hungry again as I ever was in my life." "I thought likely you would be," said Mrs. Comstock, "and so I got supper ready. We can eat first, and do the work afterward. What kept you so? I expected you an hour ago." Elnora looked into her mother's face and smiled. It was a queer sort of a little smile, and would have reached the depths with any normal mother. "I see you've been bawling," said Mrs. Comstock. "I thought you'd get your fill in a hurry. That's why I wouldn't go to any expense. If we keep out of the poorhouse we have to cut the corners close. It's likely this brushwood road tax will eat up all we've saved in years. Where the land tax is to come from I don't know. It gets bigger every year. If they are going to dredge the swamp ditch again they'll just have to take the land to pay for it. I can't, that's all. We'll get up early in the morning and gather and haul the beans for winter, and put in the rest of the day hoeing the turnips." Elnora again smiled that pitiful smile. "Do you think I didn't know that I was funny and would be laughed at?" she asked. "Funny?" cried Mrs. Comstock hotly. "Yes, funny. A regular caricature," answered Elnora. "No one else wore calico, not even one other. No one else wore high heavy shoes, not even one. No one else had such a funny little old hat. My hair was not right, my ribbon invisible compared with the others. I did not know where to go, or what to do, and I had no books. What a spectacle I made for them." Elnora laughed nervously at her own picture. "But there are always two sides. The professor said in the algebra class that he never had a better solution and explanation than mine of the proposition he gave me, which scored one for me in spite of my clothes. Well, I wouldn't brag on myself." "That was poor taste," admitted Elnora. "But, you see, it is a case of whistling to keep up my courage. I honestly could see that I would have looked just as well as the rest of them if I had been dressed as they were. We can't afford that, so I have to find something else to brace me. It was rather bad, Mother." "Well, I'm glad you got enough of it." "Oh, but I haven't," hurried in Elnora. "I just got a start. The hardest is over. Tomorrow they won't be surprised. They will know what to expect. I am sorry to hear about the dredge. Is it really going through?" "Yes. I got my notification today. The tax will be something enormous. I don't know as I can spare you, even if you are willing to be a laughingstock for the town." With every bite Elnora's courage returned, for she was a healthy young thing. "You've heard about doing evil that good might come from it," she said. "Well, mother mine, it's something like that with me. I'm willing to bear the hard part to pay for what I learn. Already I have selected the ward building in which I shall teach in about 4 years. I am going to ask for a room with a south exposure so that the flowers and moths I taken from the swamp to show the children will do well." "You little idiot," said Mrs. Comstock. "How are you going to pay your expenses?" "Now that is just what I was going to ask you," said Elnora. "You see, I have had two startling pieces of news today. I did not know I would need any money. I thought the city furnished the books, and there is an out-of-town tuition, also. I need $10 in the morning. Will you please let me have it?"
$10, cried Mrs. Comstock. $10. Why don't you say 100 and be done with it? I could get one as easy as the other. I told you I couldn't raise a cent. Every year expenses grow bigger and bigger. I told you not to ask for money."
"I never meant to," replied Elnora. "I thought clothes were all I needed and I could bear them. I never knew about buying books and tuition."
"Well, I did," said Mrs. Comstock. "I knew what you would run into. But you are so bulldog stubborn, and so set in your way, I thought I would just let you try the world a little and see how you liked it."
Elnora pushed back her chair and looked at her mother. "Do you mean to say," she demanded, "that you knew, when you let me go into a city classroom and reveal the fact before all of them that I expected to have my books handed out to me, do you mean to say that you knew I had to pay for them?"
Mrs. Comstock evaded the direct question. "Anybody but an idiot mooning over a book or wasting time prowling the woods would have known you had to pay. Everybody has to pay for everything. Life is made up of pay, pay, pay. It's always and forever pay. If you don't pay one way you do another. Of course, I knew you had to pay. Of course, I knew you would come home blubbering. But you don't get a penny. I haven't 1 cent, and can't get one. Have your way if you are determined, but I think you will find the road somewhat rocky.
Swampy, you mean, mother, corrected Eleonora. She arose white and trembling. Perhaps someday God will teach me how to understand you. He knows I do not now. You can't possibly realize just what you let me go through today, or how you let me go, but I'll tell you this, you understand enough that if you had the money, and would offer it to me, I wouldn't touch it now. And I'll tell you this much more. I'll get it myself. I'll raise it, and do it some honest way. I am going back tomorrow, the next day, and the next. You need not come out, I'll do the night work, and hoe the turnips.
It was 10 o'clock when the chickens, pigs, and cattle were fed, the turnips hoed, and a heap of bean vines was stacked beside the back door.
Chapter 2. Wherein Wesley and Margaret go shopping, and Elnora's wardrobe is replenished. Wesley Sinton walked down the road half a mile and turned at the lane leading to his home. His heart was hot and filled with indignation. He had told Elnora he did not blame her mother, but he did. His wife met him at the door.
"Did you see anything of Elnora?" she questioned.
"Most too much, Maggie," he answered. "What do you say to going to town? There's a few things has to be got right away."
"Where did you see her, Wesley?"
"Along the old Limberlost trail, my girl, torn to pieces sobbing. Her courage always has been fine, but the thing she met today was too much for her. We ought to have known better than to let her go that way. It wasn't only clothes, there were books, and entrance fees for out-of-town people, that she didn't know about, while there must have been jeers, whispers, and laughing. Maggie, I feel as if I'd been a traitor to those girls of ours. I ought to have gone in and seen about this school business. Don't cry, Maggie. Get me some supper, and I'll hitch up and see what we can do now."
"What can we do, Wesley?"
"I don't just know. But we've got to do something. Kate Comstock will be a handful, while Elnora will be too, but between us we must see that the girl is not too hard-pressed about money, and that she is dressed so she is not ridiculous. She saved us the wages of a woman many a day, can't you make her some decent dresses?"
"Well, I'm not just what you call expert, but I could beat Kate Comstock all to pieces. I know that skirts should be pleated to the band instead of gathered, and full enough to sit in, and short enough to walk in. I could try. There are patterns for sale. Let's go right away, Wesley.
Set me a bit of supper, while I hitch up." Margaret built a fire, made coffee, and fried ham and eggs. She set out pie and cake and had enough for a hungry man by the time the carriage was at the door, but she had no appetite. She dressed while Wesley ate, put away the food while he dressed, and then they drove toward the city through the beautiful September evening, and as they went they planned for Elnora. The trouble was, not whether they were generous enough to buy what she needed, but whether she would accept their purchases, and what her mother would say. They went to a dry goods store and when a clerk asked what they wanted to see neither of them knew, so they stepped aside and held a whispered consultation.
"What had we better get, Wesley?"
"Dresses," said Wesley promptly.
"But how many dresses, and what kind?"
"Blessed if I know," exclaimed Wesley. "I thought you would manage that. I know about some things I'm going to get." At that instant several high school girls came into the store and approached them.
"There!" exclaimed Wesley breathlessly.
"There, Maggie. Like them. That's what she needs. Buy like they have."
Margaret stared. What did they wear? They were rapidly passing, they seemed to have so much, and she could not decide so quickly. Before she knew it she was among them.
"I beg your pardon, but won't you wait 1 minute?" she asked. The girls stopped with wondering faces.
"It's your clothes," explained Mrs. Sinton. "You look just beautiful to me. You look exactly as I should have wanted to see my girls. They both died of diphtheria when they were little, but they had yellow hair, dark eyes and pink cheeks, and everybody thought they were lovely. If they had lived, they'd been near your age now, and I'd want them to look like you." There was sympathy on every girl face.
"Why thank you," said one of them. "We are very sorry for you."
"Of course you are," said Margaret. "Everybody always has been. And because I can't ever have the joy of a mother in thinking for my girls and buying pretty things for them, there is nothing left for me, but to do what I can for someone who has no mother to care for her. I know a girl, who would be just as pretty as any of you, if she had the clothes, but her mother does not think about her, so I mother her some myself."
"She must be a lucky girl," said another.
"Oh, she loves me," said Margaret, "and I love her. I want her to look just like you do. Please tell me about your clothes. Are these the dresses and hats you wear to school?"
What kind of goods are they, and where do you buy them? The girls began to laugh and cluster around Margaret. Wesley strode down the store with his head high through pride in her, but his heart was sore over the memory of two little faces under brushwood sod. He inquired his way to the shoe department. "Why, every one of us have on gingham or linen dresses," they said, "and they are our school clothes." For a few moments there was a babel of laughing voices explaining to the delighted Margaret that school dresses should be bright and pretty, but simple and plain, and until cold weather they should wash. "I'll tell you," said Ellen Brownlee, "my father owns this store, I know all the clerks. I'll take you to Miss Hartley. You tell her just how much you want to spend, and what you want to buy, and she will know how to get the most for your money. I've heard Papa say she was the best clerk in the store for people who didn't know precisely what they wanted."
"That's the very thing," agreed Margaret. "But before you go, tell me about your hair. Elnora's hair is bright and wavy, but yours is silky as hackled flax. How do you do it?"
"Elnora?" asked four girls in concert. "Yes, Elnora is the name of the girl I want these things for."
"Did she come to the high school today?" questioned one of them.
"Was she in your classes?" demanded Margaret without reply. Four girls stood silent and thought fast. Had there been a strange girl among them, and had she been overlooked and passed by with indifference, because she was so very shabby? If she had appeared as much better than they, as she had looked worse, would her reception have been the same?
"There was a strange girl from the country in the freshman class today," said Ellen Brownlee, "and her name was Elnora."
"That was the girl," said Margaret.
"Are her people so very poor?" questioned Ellen.
"No, not poor at all, come to think of it," answered Margaret. "It's a peculiar case. Mrs. Comstock had a great trouble and she let it change her whole life and make a different woman of her. She used to be lovely, now she is forever saving and scared to death for fear they will go to the poorhouse, but there is a big farm, covered with lots of good timber. The taxes are high for women who can't manage to clear and work the land. There ought to be enough to keep two of them in good shape all their lives, if they only knew how to do it. But no one ever told Kate Comstock anything, and never will, for she won't listen. All she does is droop all day, and walk the edge of the swamp half the night, and neglect Elnora. If you girls would make life just a little easier for her, it would be the finest thing you ever did." All of them promised they would.
"Now tell me about your hair," persisted Margaret Simpton. So they took her to a toilet counter, and she bought the proper hair soap, also a nail file, and cold cream, for use after windy days. Then they left her with the experienced clerk, and when at last Wesley found her she was loaded with bundles and the light of other days was in her beautiful eyes. Wesley also carried some packages.
"Did you get any stockings?" he whispered.
"No, I didn't," she said. "I was so interested in dresses and hair ribbons and a hat," she hesitated and glanced at Wesley.
"Of course, a hat," prompted Wesley. "That I forgot all about those horrible shoes. She's got to have decent shoes, Wesley."
"Sure," said Wesley. "She's got decent shoes. But the man said some brown stockings ought to go with them. Take a peep, will you?" Wesley opened a box and displayed a pair of thick soled, beautifully shaped brown walking shoes of low cut. Margaret cried out with pleasure.
"But do you suppose they are the right size, Wesley? What did you get?"
"I just said for a girl of 16 with a slender foot."
"Well, that's about as near as I could come. If they don't fit when she tries them, we will drive straight in and change them. Come on now, let's get home." All the way they discussed how they should give Elnora their purchases and what Mrs. Comstock would say.
"I'm afraid she will be awful mad," said Margaret.
"She'll just trip," replied Wesley graphically. "But if she wants to leave the raising of her girl to the neighbors, she needn't get fractious if they take some pride in doing a good job. From now on I calculate Elnora shall go to school, and she shall have all the clothes and books she needs, if I go around on the back of Kate Comstock's land and cut a tree, or drive off a calf to pay for them. Why, I know one tree she owns that would put Elnora in heaven for a year. Just think of it, Margaret. It's not fair. One third of what is there belongs to Elnora by law, and if Kate Comstock raises a row I'll tell her so, and see that the girl gets it. You go to see Kate in the morning, and I'll go with you. Tell her you want Elnora's pattern, that you are going to make her a dress, for helping us. And sort of hinted a few more things. If Kate balks, I'll take a hand and settle her. I'll go to law for Elnora's share of that land and sell enough to educate her."
"Why, Wesley Simpton, you're perfectly wild."
"I'm not. Did you ever stop to think that such cases are so frequent there have been laws made to provide for them? I can bring it up in court and force Kate to educate Elnora,
and board and clothe her till she's of age, and then she can take her share.
Wesley, Kate would go crazy.
She's crazy now. The idea of any mother living with as sweet a girl as Elnora and letting her suffer till I find her crying like a funeral. It makes me fighting mad. All uncalled for. Not a grain of sense in it. I've offered and offered to oversee clearing her land and working her fields. Let her sell a good tree, or a few acres. Something is going to be done, right now.
Elnora's been fairly happy up to this, but to spoil the school life she's planned, is to ruin all her life. I won't have it. If Elnora won't take these things, so help me, I'll tell her what she is worth, and loan her the money and she can pay me back when she comes of age. I am going to have it out with Kate Comstock in the morning. Here we are. You open up what you got while I put away the horses, and then I'll show you.
When Wesley came from the barn, Margaret had four pieces of crisp gingham, a pale blue, a pink, a gray with green stripes and a rich brown and blue plaid. On each of them lay a yard and a half of wide ribbon to match. There were handkerchiefs and a brown leather belt. In her hands she held a wide-brimmed tan straw hat, having a high crown banded with velvet strips, each of which fastened with a tiny gold buckle.
It looks kind of bare now, she explained. It had three quills on it here.
Did you have them taken off? Asked Wesley.
Yes, I did. The price was 2.5 for the hat, and those things were $1.50 apiece. I couldn't pay that.
It does seem considerable, admitted Wesley, but will it look right without them?
No, it won't, said Margaret. It's going to have quills on it. Do you remember those beautiful peacock wing feathers that Phoebe Sims gave me? Three of them go on just where those came off, and nobody will ever know the difference. They match the hat to a moral, and they are just a little longer and richer than the ones that I had taken off. I was wondering whether I better sew them on tonight while I remember how they set, or wait till morning.
Don't risk it, exclaimed Wesley anxiously.
Don't you risk it. Sew them on right now.
Open your bundles, while I get the thread, said Margaret.
Wesley unwrapped the shoes. Margaret took them up and pinched the leather and stroked them.
My, but they are fine, she cried.
Wesley picked up one and slowly turned it in his big hands. He glanced at his foot and back to the shoe.
It's a little bit of a thing, Margaret, he said softly. Like as not I'll have to take it back. It seems as if it couldn't fit.
It seems as if it didn't dare do anything else, said Margaret. That's a happy little shoe to get the chance to carry as fine a girl as Elnora to high school. Now what's in the other box?
Wesley looked at Margaret doubtfully.
Why, he said, you know there's going to be rainy days, and those things she has now ain't fit for anything but to drive up the cows.
Wesley, did you get high shoes, too?
Well, she ought to have them. The man said he would make them cheaper if I took both pairs at once.
Margaret laughed aloud. Those will do her past Christmas, she exulted. What else did you buy?
Well, sir, said Wesley, I saw something today. You told me about Kate getting the tin pail for Elnora to carry to high school and you said you told her it was a shame. I guess Elnora was ashamed all right, for tonight she stopped at the old case Duncan gave her, and took out that pail, where it had been all day, and put a napkin inside it. Coming home she confessed she was half-starved because she hid her dinner under a culvert, and a tramp took it. She hadn't had a bite to eat the whole day. But she never complained at all, she was pleased that she hadn't lost the napkin. So I just inquired around till I found this, and I think it's about the ticket.
Wesley opened the package and laid a brown leather lunchbox on the table. Might be a couple of books, or drawing tools or most anything that's neat and genteel. You see, it opens this way.
It did open, and inside was a space for sandwiches, a little porcelain box for cold meat or fried chicken, another for salad, a glass with a lid which screwed on, held by a ring in a corner, for custard or jelly, a flask for tea or milk, a beautiful little knife, fork, and spoon fastened in holders, and a place for a napkin.
Margaret was almost crying over it.
How I'd love to fill it, she exclaimed.
Do it the first time, just to show Kate Comstock what love is, said Wesley. Get up early in the morning and make one of those dresses tomorrow. Can't you make a plain gingham dress in a day? I'll pick a chicken, and you fry it and fix a little custard for the cup, and do it up brown. Go on, Maggie, you do it.
I never can, said Margaret. I am slow as the itch about sewing, and these are not going to be plain dresses when it comes to making them. There are going to be edgings of plain green, pink, and brown to the bias strips, and tucks and pleats around the hips, fancy belts and collars, and all of it takes time.
Then Kate Comstock's got to help, said Wesley. Can the two of you make one, and get that lunch tomorrow?
easy, but she'll never do it.
You see if she doesn't, said Wesley. You get up and cut it out, and soon as Elnora is gone I'll go after Kate myself. She'll take what I'll say better alone. But she'll come, and she'll help make the dress. These other things are our Christmas gifts to Elnora. She'll no doubt need them more now than she will then, and we can give them just as well. That's yours, and this is mine, or whichever way you choose.
Wesley untied a good brown umbrella and shook out the folds of a long, brown raincoat. Margaret dropped the hat, arose and took the coat. She tried it on, felt it, cooed over it and matched it with the umbrella.
Did it look anything like rain tonight? She inquired so anxiously that Wesley laughed.
And this last bundle? She said, dropping back in her chair, the coat still over her shoulders.
I couldn't buy this much stuff for any other woman and nothing for my own, said Wesley.
It's Christmas for you, too, Margaret. He shook out fold after fold of soft gray satiny goods that would look lovely against Margaret's pink cheeks and whitening hair.
Oh, you old darling! She exclaimed, and fled sobbing into his arms.
But she soon dried her eyes, raked together the coals in the cooking stove and boiled one of the dress patterns in salt water for half an hour. Wesley held the lamp while she hung the goods on the line to dry. Then she set the irons on the stove so they would be hot the first thing in the morning.
Chapter 3. Wherein Elnora visits the bird woman, and opens a bank account.
4 o'clock the following morning Elnora was shelling beans. At 6 she fed the chickens and pigs, swept 2 of the rooms of the cabin, built a fire, and put on the kettle for breakfast. Then she climbed the narrow stairs to the attic she had occupied since a very small child, and dressed in the hated shoes and brown calico, plastered down her crisp curls, ate what breakfast she could, and pinning on her hat started for town.
There is no sense in your going for an hour yet, said her mother.
I must try to discover some way to earn those books, replied Elnora. I am perfectly positive I shall not find them lying beside the road wrapped in tissue paper, and tagged with my name. She went toward the city as on yesterday. Her perplexity as to where tuition and books were to come from was worse, but she did not feel quite so badly. She never again would have to face all of it for the first time. There had been times yesterday when she had prayed to be hidden, or to drop dead, and neither had happened.
I believe the best way to get an answer to prayer is to work for it, muttered Elnora grimly.
Again she followed the trail to the swamp, rearranged her hair and left the tin pail. This time she folded a couple of sandwiches in the napkin, and tied them in a neat light paper parcel which she carried in her hand. Then she hurried along the road to Onabasha and found a bookstore. There she asked the prices of the list of books that she needed, and learned that $6 would not quite supply them. She anxiously inquired for second-hand books, but was told that the only way to secure them was from the last year's freshmen. Just then Elnora felt that she positively could not approach any of those she supposed to be sophomores and ask to buy their old books. The only balm the girl could see for the humiliation of yesterday was to appear that day with a set of new books.
Do you wish these? Asked the clerk hurriedly, for the store was rapidly filling with school children wanting anything from a dictionary to a pen.
Yes, gasped Elnora, oh, yes. But I cannot pay for them just now. Please let me take them, and I will pay for them on Friday, or return them as perfect as they are. Please trust me for them a few days.
I'll ask the proprietor, he said.
When he came back Elnora knew the answer before he spoke.
I'm sorry, he said, but Mr. Hahn doesn't recognize your name. You are not a customer of ours, and he feels that he can't take the risk.
Elnora clumped out of the store, the thump of her heavy, shoes beating as a hammer on her brain. She tried 2 other dealers with the same result, and then in sick despair came into the street. What could she do? She was too frightened to think. Should she stay from school that day and canvass the homes appearing to belong to the wealthy, and try to sell beds of wild ferns, as she had suggested to Wesley Sinton? What would she dare ask for bringing in and planting a clump of ferns? How could she carry them? Would people buy them? She slowly moved past the hotel and then glanced around to see if there were a clock anywhere, for she felt sure the young people passing her constantly were on their way to school. There it stood in a bank window in big black letters staring straight at her.
Wanted, caterpillars, cocoons, chrysalides, pupae cases, butterflies, moths, Indian relics of all kinds. Highest scale of prices paid in cash.
Elnora caught the wicket at the cashier's desk with both hands to brace herself against disappointment.
Who is it wants to buy cocoons, butterflies, and moths? She panted.
The bird woman, answered the cashier. Have you some for sale?
I have some, I do not know if they are what she would want.
Well, you had better see her, said the cashier. Do you know where she lives?
Yes,
said Eleonora. Would you tell me the time?
8:21, was the answer. She had 9 minutes to reach the auditorium or be late. Should she go to school, or to the bird woman? Several girls passed her walking swiftly and she remembered their faces. They were hurrying to school. Eleonora caught the infection. She would see the bird woman at noon. Algebra came first, and that professor was kind. Perhaps she could slip to the superintendent and ask him for a book for the next lesson, and at noon, oh, dear Lord, make it come true, prayed Eleonora. At noon possibly she could sell some of those wonderful shining winged things she had been collecting all her life around the outskirts of the Limberlost. As she went down a long hall she noticed the professor of mathematics standing in the door of his recitation room. When she passed him he smiled and spoke to her. I have been watching for you, he said, and Eleonora stopped bewildered.
For me? She questioned.
Yes, said Professor Henley. Step inside. Eleonora followed him into the room and closed the door behind them. At teachers' meeting last evening, one of the professors mentioned that a pupil had betrayed in class that she had expected her books to be furnished by the city. I thought possibly it was you.
Was it?
Yes, breathed Eleonora. That being the case, said Professor Henley, it just occurred to me as you had expected that, you might require a little time to secure them, and you're too fine a mathematician to fall behind for one of supplies. So I telephoned one of our sophomores to bring her last year's books this morning. I am sorry to say they are somewhat abused, but the text is all here. You can have them for $2, and pay when you are ready. Would you care to take them? Eleonora sat suddenly, because she could not stand another instant. She reached both hands for the books, and said never a word. The professor was silent also. At last Eleonora arose, hugging those books to her heart as a mother clasps a baby.
One thing more, said the professor. You may pay your tuition quarterly. You need not bother about the first installment this month. Any time in October will do.
It seemed as if Elnora's gasp of relief must have reached the soles of her brogans.
Did anyone ever tell you how beautiful you are? She cried.
As the professor was lank, tow-haired and so nearsighted, that he peered at his pupils through spectacles, no one ever had.
No, said Professor Henley, I've waited some time for that, for which reason I shall appreciate it all the more. Come now, or we shall be late for opening exercises.
So Eleonora entered the auditorium a second time. Her face was like the brightest dawn that ever broke over the Limberlost. No matter about the lumbering shoes and skimpy dress. No matter about anything, she had the books. She could take them home. In her garret she could commit them to memory, if need be. She could prove that clothes were not all. If the bird woman did not want any of the many different kinds of specimens she had collected, she was quite sure now she could sell ferns, nuts, and a great many things. Then, too, a girl made a place for her that morning, and several smiled and bowed. Eleonora forgot everything save her books, and that she was where she could use them intelligently, everything except one little thing away back in her head. Her mother had known about the books and the tuition, and had not told her when she agreed to her coming. At noon Eleonora took her little parcel of lunch and started to the home of the bird woman. She must know about the specimens first and then she would walk to the suburb somewhere and eat a few bites. She dropped the heavy iron knocker on the door of a big red log cabin, and her heart thumped at the resounding stroke.
Is the bird woman at home? She asked of the maid.
She is at lunch, was the answer. Please ask her if she will see a girl from the Limberlost about some moths? Inquired Eleonora.
I never need ask, if it's moths, laughed the girl. Orders are to bring anyone with specimens right in. Come this way.
Eleonora followed down the hall and entered a long room with high-paneled wainscoting, old English fireplace with an overmantel and closets of peculiar china filling the corners. At a bare table of oak, yellow as gold, sat a woman Eleonora often had watched and followed covertly around the Limberlost. The bird woman was holding out a hand of welcome.
I heard. She laughed. A little pasteboard box, or just the mere word specimen, passes you at my door. If it is moths I hope you have hundreds. I've been very busy all summer and unable to collect, and I need so many. Sit down and lunch with me, while we talk it over. From the Limberlost, did you say?
I live near the swamp, replied Eleonora. Since it's so cleared I dare go around the edge in daytime, though we are all afraid at night.
What have you collected? Asked the bird woman, as she helped Eleonora to sandwiches unlike any she ever before had tasted, salad that seemed to be made of many familiar things, and a cup of hot chocolate that would have delighted any hungry schoolgirl.
I am afraid I am bothering you for nothing, and imposing on you, she said. That collected frightens me. I've only gathered.
I always loved everything outdoors, so I made friends and playmates of them. When I learned that the moths die so soon, I saved them especially, because there seemed no wickedness in it.
I have thought the same thing, said the bird woman encouragingly. Then because the girl could not eat until she learned about the moths, the bird woman asked Elnora if she knew what kinds she had.
Not all of them, answered Elnora. Before Mr. Duncan moved away he often saw me near the edge of the swamp and he showed me the box he had fixed for Freckles, and gave me the key. There were some books and things, so from that time on I studied and tried to take moths right, but I am afraid they are not what you want.
Are they the big ones that fly mostly in June nights? Asked the bird woman.
Yes, said Elnora. Big gray ones with reddish markings, pale blue-green, yellow with lavender, and red and yellow.
What do you mean by red and yellow? Asked the bird woman so quickly that the girl almost jumped.
Not exactly red, explained Elnora, with tremulous voice. A reddish, yellowish brown, with canary-colored spots and gray lines on their wings.
How many of them? It was the same quick question.
I had over 200 eggs, said Elnora, but some of them didn't hatch, and some of the caterpillars died, but there must be at least 100 perfect ones.
Perfect. How perfect? Cried the bird woman.
I mean whole wings, no down gone, and all their legs and antennae, faltered Elnora.
Young woman, that's the rarest moth in America, said the bird woman solemnly. If you have 100 of them, they are worth $100 according to my list. I can use all that are not damaged.
What if they are not pinned right, quavered Elnora.
If they are perfect, that does not make the slightest difference. I know how to soften them so that I can put them into any shape I choose.
Where are they? When may I see them?
They are in Freckles' old case in the Limberlost, said Elnora. I couldn't carry many for fear of breaking them, but I could bring a few after school.
You come here at 4, said the bird woman, and we will drive out with some specimen boxes, and a price list, and see what you have to sell. Are they your very own? Are you free to part with them?
They are mine, said Elnora. No one but God knows I have them. Mr. Duncan gave me the books in the box. He told Freckles about me, and Freckles told him to give me all he left. He said for me to stick to the swamp and be brave, and my hour would come, and it has. I know most of them are all right, and oh, I do need the money.
Could you tell me? Asked the bird woman softly.
You see the swamp and all the fields around it are so full, explained Elnora. Every day I felt smaller and smaller, and I wanted to know more and more, and pretty soon I grew desperate, just as Freckles did. But I am better off than he was, for I have his books, and I have a mother, even if she doesn't care for me as other girls' mothers do for them, it's better than no one.
The bird woman's glance fell, for the girl was not conscious of how much she was revealing. Her eyes were fixed on a black pitcher filled with goldenrod in the center of the table and she was saying what she thought. As long as I could go to the brushwood school I was happy, but I couldn't go further just when things were the most interesting, so I was determined I'd come to high school and mother wouldn't consent. You see there's plenty of land, but father was drowned when I was a baby, and mother and I can't make money as men do. The taxes are higher every year, and she said it was too expensive. I wouldn't give her any rest, until at last she bought me this dress, and these shoes and I came. It was awful.
Do you live in that beautiful cabin at the northwest end of the swamp? Asked the bird woman.
Yes, said Elnora. I remember the place and a story about it, now.
You entered the high school yesterday?
Yes.
It was rather bad?
Rather bad, echoed Elnora.
The bird woman laughed.
You can't tell me anything about that, she said. I once entered a city school straight from the country. My dress was brown calico, and my shoes were heavy.
The tears began to roll down Elnora's cheeks.
Did they? She faltered.
They did, said the bird woman. All of it. I am sure they did not miss one least little thing.
Then she wiped away some tears that began coursing her cheeks, and laughed at the same time.
Where are they now? Asked Elnora suddenly.
They are widely scattered, but none of them have attained heights out of range. Some of the rich are poor, and some of the poor are rich. Some of the brightest died insane, and some of the dullest worked out high positions, some of the very worst to bear have gone out, and I frequently hear from others. Now I am here, able to remember it, and mingle laughter with what used to be all tears, for every day I have my beautiful work, and almost every day God sends someone like you to help me.
What is your name, my girl?
Elnora Comstock, answered Elnora. Yesterday on the board it changed to Cornstalk, and for a minute I thought I'd die, but I can laugh over that already.
The bird woman arose and kissed her. "Finish your lunch," she said, "and I will bring my price lists, and make a memorandum of what you think you have, so I will know how many boxes to prepare. And remember this, what you are lies with you. If you are lazy, and accept your lot, you may live in it. If you are willing to work, you can write your name anywhere you choose, among the only ones who live beyond the grave in this world, the people who write books that help, make exquisite music, carve statues, paint pictures, and work for others. Never mind the calico dress, and the coarse shoes. Work at your books, and before long you will hear yesterday's tormentors boasting that they were once classmates of yours. I could a tale unfold." She laughingly left the room and Eleonora sat thinking, until she remembered how hungry she was, so she ate the food, drank the hot chocolate and began to feel better. Then the bird woman came back and showed Eleonora a long printed slip giving a list of graduated prices for moths, butterflies, and dragonflies. "Oh, do you want them?" exulted Eleonora. "I have a few and I can get more by the thousand, with every color in the world on their wings." "Yes," said the bird woman, "I will buy them, also the big moth caterpillars that are creeping everywhere now, and the cocoons that they will spin just about this time. I have a sneaking impression that the mystery, wonder, and the urge of their pure beauty, are going to force me to picture and paint our moths and put them into a book for all the world to see and know. We Limberlost people must not be selfish with the wonders God has given to us. We must share with those poor cooped-up city people the best we can. To send them a beautiful book, that is the way, is it not, little new friend of mine?" "Yes, oh yes," cried Eleonora. "And please God they find a way to earn the money to buy the books, as I have those I need so badly." "I will pay good prices for all the moths you can find," said the bird woman, "because you see I exchange them with foreign collectors. I want a complete series of the moths of America to trade with a German scientist, another with a man in India, and another in Brazil. Others I can exchange with home collectors for those of California and Canada, so you see I can use all you can raise, or find. The banker will buy stone axes, arrow points, and Indian pipes. There was a teacher from the city grade schools here today for specimens. There is a fund to supply the ward buildings. I'll help you get in touch with that. They want leaves of different trees, flowers, grasses, moths, insects, birds' nests and anything about birds." Eleanor's eyes were blazing. "Had I better go back to school or open a bank account and begin being a millionaire? Uncle Wesley and I have a bushel of arrow points gathered, a stack of axes, pipes, skin dressing tools, tubes and mortars. I don't know how I ever shall wait 3 hours." "You must go, or you will be late," said the bird woman. "I will be ready at 4. After school closed, Eleonora, seated beside the bird woman, drove to Freckles's room in the Limberlost. One at a time the beautiful big moths were taken from the interior of the old black case. Not a fourth of them could be moved that night and it was almost dark when the last box was closed, the list figured, and into Elnora's trembling fingers were paid $59.16. Eleonora clasped the money closely. "Oh, you beautiful stuff," she cried. "You are going to buy the books, pay the tuition, and take me to high school." Then because she was a woman, she sat on a log and looked at her shoes. Long after the bird woman drove away, Eleonora remained. She had her problem, and it was a big one. If she told her mother, would she take the money to pay the taxes? If she did not tell her, how could she account for the books, and things for which she would spend it? At last she counted out what she needed for the next day, placed the remainder in the farthest corner of the case, and locked the door. She then filled the front of her skirt from a heap of arrow points beneath the case and started home. Chapter 4. Wherein the Sintons are disappointed, and Mrs. Comstock learns that she can laugh. With the first streak of red above the Limberlost, Margaret Sinton was busy with the gingham in the intricate paper pattern she had purchased. Wesley cooked the breakfast and worked until he thought Eleonora would be gone, then he started to bring her mother. "Now you be mighty careful," cautioned Margaret. "I don't know how she will take it." "I don't either," said Wesley philosophically, "but she's got to take it some way. That dress has to be finished by school time in the morning." Wesley had not slept well that night. He had been so busy framing diplomatic speeches to make to Mrs. Comstock that sleep had little chance with him. Every step nearer to her he approached his position seemed less enviable. By the time he reached the front gate and started down the walk between the rows of asters and lady slippers he was perspiring, and every plausible and convincing speech had fled his brain. Mrs. Comstock helped him. She met him at the door. "Good morning," she said. "Did Margaret send you for something?" "Yes," said Wesley. "She's got a job that's too big for her, and she wants you to help." "Of course I will," said Mrs. Comstock.
It was no one's affair how lonely the previous day had been, or how the endless hours of the present would drag. What is she doing in such a rush? Now was his chance. She's making a dress for Eleonora, answered Wesley. He saw Mrs. Comstock's form straighten, and her face harden, so he continued hastily. You see, Eleonora has been helping us at harvest time, butchering, and with unexpected visitors for years. We've made out that she saved us a considerable sum, and as she wouldn't ever touch any pay for anything, we just went to town and got a few clothes we thought would fix her up a little for the high school. We want to get a dress done today mighty bad, but Margaret is slow about sewing, and she never can finish alone, so I came after you. And it's such a simple little matter, so dead easy, and also between old friends like, that you can't look above your boots while you explain it, sneered Mrs. Comstock. Wesley Sinton, what put the idea into your head that Eleonora would take things bought with money, when she wouldn't take the money? Then Sinton's eyes came up straightly. Finding her on the trail last night sobbing as hard as I ever saw anyone at a funeral. She wasn't complaining at all, but she's come to me all her life with her little hurts, and she couldn't hide how she'd been laughed at, twitted, and run face to face against the fact that there were books and tuition, unexpected, and nothing will ever make me believe you didn't know that, Kate Comstock. If any doubts are troubling you on that subject, sure I knew it. She was so anxious to try the world, I thought I'd just let her take a few knocks and see how she liked them. As if she'd ever taken anything but knocks all her life, cried Wesley Sinton. Kate Comstock, you are a heartless, selfish woman. You've never shown Eleonora any real love in her life. If ever she finds out the thing, you'll lose her, and it will serve you right. She knows it now, said Mrs. Comstock icily, and she'll be home tonight just as usual. Well, you are a brave woman if you dared put a girl of Eleonora's make through what she suffered yesterday, and will suffer again today, and let her know you did it on purpose. I admire your nerve. But I've watched this since Eleonora was born, and I got enough. Things have come to a pass where they go better for her, or I interfere. As if you'd ever done anything but interfere all her life. Think I haven't watched you? Think I, with my heart raw in my breast, and too numb to resent it openly, haven't seen you and Mag Sinton trying to turn Eleonora against me day after day? When did you ever tell her what her father meant to me? When did you ever try to make her see the wreck of my life, and what I've suffered? No indeed. Always it's been poor little abused Eleonora, and cakes, kissing, extra clothes, and encouraging her to run to you with a pitiful mouth every time I tried to make a woman of her. Kate Comstock, that's unjust, cried Sinton. Only last night I tried to show her the picture I saw the day she was born. I begged her to come to you and tell you pleasant what she needed, and ask you for what I happen to know you can well afford to give her. I can't, cried Mrs. Comstock. You know why I can't. Then get so you can, said Wesley Sinton. Any day you say the word you can sell 6,000 worth of rare timber off this place easy. I'll see to clearing and working the fields cheap as dirt, for Eleonora's sake. I'll buy you more cattle to fatten. All you've got to do is sign a lease, to pull thousands from the ground in oil, as the rest of us are doing all around you. Cut down Robert's trees, shrieked Mrs. Comstock. Tear up his land. Cover everything with horrid, greasy oil. I'll die first. You mean you'll let Eleonora go like a beggar, and hurt and mortify her past bearing? I've got to the place where I tell you plain what I'm going to do. Maggie and I went to town last night, and we bought what things Eleonora needs most urgent to make her look a little like the rest of the high school girls. Now here it is in plain English. You can help get these things ready, and let us give them to her as we want. She won't touch them, cried Mrs. Comstock. Then you can pay us, and she can take them as her right. I won't. Then I will tell Eleonora just what you are worth, what you can afford, and how much of this she owns. I'll loan her the money to buy books and decent clothes, and when she is of age she can sell her share and pay me. Mrs. Comstock gripped a chair back and opened her lips, but no words came. And, Sinton continued, if she is so much like you that she won't do that, I'll go to the county seat and lay complaint against you as her guardian before the judge. I'll swear to what you are worth, and how you are raising her, and have you discharged, or have the judge appoint some man who will see that she is comfortable, educated, and decent looking. You wouldn't, gasped Kate Comstock. I won't need to, Kate, said Sinton, his heart softening the instant the hard words were said. You won't show it, but you do love Eleonora. You can't help it. You must see how she needs things, come help us fix them, and be friends. Maggie and I couldn't live without her, and you couldn't either. You've got to love such a fine girl as she is, let it show a little. You can hardly expect me to love her, said Mrs. Comstock coldly.
But for her, a man would stand back of me now, who would beat the breath out of your sneaking body for the cowardly thing with which you threaten me. After all I've suffered, you drag me to court and compel me to tear up Robert's property. If I ever go, they carry me. If they touch one tree, or put down one greasy old oil well, it will be over all I can shoot, before they begin. Now, see how quick you can clear out of here. You won't come and help Maggie with the dress? For answer, Mrs. Comstock looked around swiftly for some object on which to lay her hands. Knowing her temper, Wesley Sinton left with all the haste consistent with dignity. But he did not go home. He crossed a field, and in an hour brought another neighbor who was skillful with her needle. With sinking heart, Margaret saw them coming. "Kate is too busy to help today, she can't sew before tomorrow," said Wesley cheerfully as they entered. That quieted Margaret's apprehension a little, though she had some doubts. Wesley prepared the lunch, and by 4 o'clock the dress was finished as far as it possibly could be until it was fitted on Eleonora. If that did not entail too much work, it could be completed in 2 hours. Then Margaret packed their purchases into the big market basket. Wesley took the hat, umbrella, and raincoat, and they went to Mrs. Comstock's. As they reached the step, Margaret spoke pleasantly to Mrs. Comstock, who sat reading just inside the door, but she did not answer and deliberately turned a leaf without looking up. Wesley Sinton opened the door and went in, followed by Margaret. "Kate," he said, "you needn't take out your mat over our little racket on Maggie. I ain't told her a word I said to you, or you said to me. She's not so very strong, and she's sewed since 4 o'clock this morning to get this dress ready for tomorrow. It's done and we came down to try it on Eleonora." "Is that the truth, Mag Sinton?" demanded Mrs. Comstock.
"You heard Wesley say so," proudly affirmed Mrs. Sinton.
"I want to make you a proposition," said Wesley. "Wait till Eleonora comes. Then we'll show her the things and see what she says."
"How would it do to see what she says without bribing her?" sneered Mrs. Comstock.
"If she can stand what she did yesterday, and will today, she can bear most anything," said Wesley. "Put away the clothes if you want to, till we tell her."
"Well, you don't take this waste time working on," said Margaret, "for I have to baste in the sleeves and set the collar. Put the rest out of sight if you like."
Mrs. Comstock picked up the basket and bundles, placed them inside her room and closed the door. Margaret threaded her needle and began to sew. Mrs. Comstock returned to her book, while Wesley fidgeted and raged inwardly. He could see that Margaret was nervous and almost in tears, but the lines in Mrs. Comstock's impassive face were set and cold. So they sat while the clock ticked off the time, 1 hour, 2, dusk, and no Eleonora. Just when Margaret and Wesley were discussing whether he had not better go to town to meet Eleonora, they heard her coming up the walk. Wesley dropped his tilted chair and squared himself. Margaret gripped her sewing, and turned pleading eyes toward the door. Mrs. Comstock closed her book and grimly smiled.
"Mother, please open the door," called Eleonora.
Mrs. Comstock arose, and swung back the screen. Eleonora stepped in beside her, bent half-double, the whole front of her dress gathered into a sort of bag filled with a heavy load, and one arm stacked high with books. In the dim light she did not see the sentence.
"Please hand me the empty bucket in the kitchen, Mother," she said. "I just had to bring these arrow points home, but I'm scared for fear I've spoiled my dress and will have to wash it. I'm to clean them, and take them to the banker in the morning, and oh, Mother, I've sold enough stuff to pay for my books, my tuition, and maybe a dress and some lighter shoes besides. Oh, Mother, I'm so happy. Take the books and bring the bucket." Then she saw Margaret and Wesley.
"Oh, glory!" she exulted. "I was just wondering how I'd ever wait to tell you, and here you are. It's too perfectly splendid to be true."
"Tell us, Eleonora," said Sinton.
"Well, sir," said Eleonora, doubling down on the floor and spreading out her skirt, "set the bucket here, Mother. These points are brittle, and should be put in one at a time. If they are chipped I can't sell them.
Well, sir, I've had a time. You know I just had to have books. I tried 3 stores, and they wouldn't trust me, not even 3 days. I didn't know what in this world I could do quickly enough. Just when I was almost frantic I saw a sign in a bank window asking for caterpillars, cocoons, butterflies, arrow points, and everything. I went in, and it was this bird woman who wants the insects, and the banker wants the stones. I had to go to school then, but, if you'll believe it," Eleonora beamed on all of them in turn as she talked and slipped the arrow points from her dress to the pail, "if you'll believe it, but you won't, hardly, until you look at the books. There was the mathematics teacher, waiting at his door, and he had a set of books for me that he had telephoned a sophomore to bring."
"How did he happen to do that, Eleonora?" interrupted Sinton.
Elnora blushed. It was a fool mistake I made yesterday in thinking books were just handed out to one. There was a teacher's meeting last night and the history teacher told about that. Professor Henley thought of me. You know I told you what he said about my algebra, mother. Ain't I glad I studied out some of it myself this summer. So he telephoned and a girl brought the books. Because they are marked and abused some I get the whole outfit for $2. I can erase most of the marks, paste down the covers, and fix them so they look better. But I must hurry to the joy part. I didn't stop to eat. At noon, I just ran to the Bird Woman's, and I had lunch with her. It was salad, hot chocolate, and lovely things, and she wants to buy most every old scrap I ever gathered. She wants dragonflies, moths, butterflies, and he the banker, I mean wants everything Indian. This very night she came to the swamp with me and took away enough stuff to pay for the books and tuition, and tomorrow she is going to buy some more. Elnora laid the last arrow point in the pail and arose, shaking leaves and bits of baked earth from her dress. She reached into her pocket, produced her money and waved it before their wandering eyes. And that's the joy part. She exulted. Put it up in the clock till morning, mother. That pays for the books and tuition and Elnora hesitated, for she saw the nervous grasp with which her mother's fingers closed on the bills. Then she continued, but more slowly and thinking before she spoke. What I get tomorrow pays for more books and tuition, and maybe a few, just a few, things to wear. These shoes are so dreadfully heavy and hot, and they make such a noise on the floor. There isn't another calico dress in the whole building, not among hundreds of us. Why, what is that? Aunt Margaret, what are you hiding in your lap? She snatched the waist and shook it out, and her face was beaming. Have you taken to waists all fancy and buttoned in the back? I bet you this is mine. I bet you so too, said Margaret Sinton. You undress right away and try it on, and if it fits, it will be done for morning. There are some low shoes, too. Elnora began to dance. Oh, you dear people! She cried. I can pay for them tomorrow night. Isn't it too splendid? I was just thinking on the way home that I certainly would be compelled to have cooler shoes until later, and I was wondering what I'd do when the fall rains begin. I meant to get you some heavy dress skirts and a coat then, said Mrs. Comstock. I know you said so, cried Elnora. But you needn't, now. I can buy every single stitch I need myself. Next summer I can gather up a lot more stuff, and all winter on the way to school. I am sure I can sell ferns, I know I can nuts, and the Bird Woman says the great rooms want leaves, grasses, birds' nests, and cocoons. Oh, isn't this world lovely? I'll be helping with the tax, next, mother. Elnora waved the waist and started for the bedroom. When she opened the door she gave a little cry. What have you people been doing? She demanded. I never saw so many interesting bundles in all my life. I'm scared to death for fear I can't pay for them, and will have to give up something. Wouldn't you take them, if you could not pay for them, Elnora? Asked her mother instantly. Why, not unless you did, answered Elnora. People have no right to wear things they can't afford, have they? But from such old friends as Maggie and Wesley. Mrs. Comstock's voice was oily with triumph. From them least of all, cried Elnora stoutly. From a stranger sooner than from them, to whom I owe so much more than I ever can pay now. Well, you don't have to, said Mrs. Comstock. Maggie just selected these things, because she is more in touch with the world, and has got such good taste. You can pay as long as your money holds out, and if there's more necessary, maybe I can sell the butcher a calf, or if things are too costly for us, of course, they can take them back. Put on the waist now, and then you can look over the rest and see if they are suitable, and what you want. Elnora stepped into the adjoining room and closed the door. Mrs. Comstock picked up the bucket and started for the well with it. At the bedroom she paused. Elnora, were you going to wash these arrow points? Yes. The Bird Woman says they sell better if they are clean, so it can be seen that there are no defects in them. Of course, said Mrs. Comstock. Some of them seem quite baked. Shall I put them to soak? Do you want to take them in the morning? Yes, I do, answered Elnora. If you would just fill the pail with water. Mrs. Comstock left the room. Wesley Sinton sat with his back to the window in the west end of the cabin which overlooked the well. A suppressed sound behind him caused him to turn quickly. Then he arose and leaned over Margaret. She's out there laughing like a blamed monkey, he whispered indignantly. Well, she can't help it, exclaimed Margaret. I'm going home, said Wesley. Oh no, you are not, retorted Margaret. You are missing the point. The point is not how you look, or feel.
It is to get these things in Elnora's possession past dispute. You go now, and tomorrow Elnora will wear calico, and Kate Comstock will return these goods. Right here I stay until everything we bought is Elnora's.
What are you going to do? Asked Wesley.
I don't know yet, myself, said Margaret. Then she arose and peered from the window. At the well curb stood Catherine Comstock. The strain of the day was finding reaction. Her chin was in the air, she was heaving, shaking and strangling to suppress any sound. The word that slipped between Margaret Sinton's lips shocked Wesley until he dropped on his chair, and recalled her to her senses. She was fairly composed as she turned to Elnora, and began the fitting. When she had pinched, pulled, and patted she called, "Come see if you think this fits, Kate." Mrs. Comstock had gone around to the back door and answered from the kitchen. "You know more about it than I do. Go ahead. I'm getting supper. Don't forget to allow for what it will shrink in washing. I set the colors and washed the goods last night, it can be made to fit right now," answered Margaret. When she could find nothing more to alter she told Elnora to heat some water. After she had done that the girl began opening packages. The hat came first. "Mother!" cried Elnora. "Mother, of course, you have seen this, but you haven't seen it on me. I must try it on."
"Don't you dare put that on your head until your hair is washed and properly combed," said Margaret.
"Oh!" cried Elnora. "Is that water to wash my hair? I thought it was to set the color in another dress."
"Well, you thought wrong," said Margaret simply. "Your hair is going to be washed and brushed until it shines like copper. While it dries you can eat your supper, and this dress will be finished. Then you can put on your new ribbon, and your hat. You can try your shoes now, and if they don't fit, you and Wesley can drive to town and change them. That little round bundle on the top of the basket is your stockings." Margaret sat down and began sewing swiftly, and a little later opened the machine, and ran several long seams. Elnora returned in a few minutes holding up her skirts and stepping daintily in the new shoes.
"Don't soil them, honey, else you're sure they fit," cautioned Wesley.
"They seem just a trifle large, maybe," said Elnora dubiously, and Wesley knelt to feel. He and Margaret thought them a fit, and then Elnora appealed to her mother. Mrs. Comstock appeared wiping her hands on her apron. She examined the shoes critically.
"They seem to fit," she said, "but they are a way too fine to walk country roads."
"I think so, too," said Elnora instantly. "We had better take these back and get a cheaper pair."
"Oh, let them go for this time," said Mrs. Comstock. "They are so pretty, I hate to part with them. You can get cheaper ones after this."
Wesley and Margaret scarcely breathed for a long time. When Wesley went to do the feeding, Elnora set the table. When the water was hot, Margaret pinned a big towel around Elnora's shoulders and washed and dried the lovely hair according to the instructions she had been given the previous night. As the hair began to dry it billowed out in a sparkling sheen that caught the light and gleamed and flashed. "Now, the idea is to let it stand naturally, just as the curl will make it. Don't you do any of that nasty, untidy snarling, Elnora," cautioned Margaret. "Wash it this way every 2 weeks while you are in school, shake it out, and dry it. Then part it in the middle and turn a front quarter on each side from your face. You tie the back at your neck with a string so, and the ribbon goes in a big, loose bow. I'll show you." One after another Margaret Sinton tied the ribbons, creasing each of them so they could not be returned, as she explained that she was trying to find the color most becoming. Then she produced the raincoat which carried Elnora into transports. Mrs. Comstock objected. "That won't be warm enough for cold weather, and you can't afford it in a coat, too."
"I'll tell you what I thought," said Elnora. "I was planning on the way home. These coats are fine because they keep you dry. I thought I would get one, and a warm sweater to wear under it cold days. Then I always would be dry, and warm. The sweater only costs $3, so I could get it and the raincoat both for half the price of a heavy cloth coat."
"You are right about that," said Mrs. Comstock. "You can change more with the weather, too. Keep the raincoat, Elnora."
"Wear it until you try the hat," said Margaret. "It will have to do until the dress is finished."
Elnora picked up the hat dubiously.
"Mother, may I wear my hair as it is now?" she asked.
"Let me take a good look," said Catherine Comstock. Heaven only knows what she saw. To Wesley and to Margaret the bright young face of Elnora, with its pink tints, its heavy dark brows, its bright blue-gray eyes, and its frame of curling reddish-brown hair was the sweetest sight on earth, and at that instant Elnora was radiant.
"So long as it's your own hair, and combed back as plain as it will go, I don't suppose it cuts much ice whether it's tied a little tighter or looser," conceded Mrs. Comstock. If you stop right there, you may let it go at that. Elnora set the hat on her head. It was only a wide tan straw with three exquisite peacock quills at one side. Margaret Sinton cried out. Wesley slapped his knee and sighed deeply while Mrs. Comstock stood speechless for a second.
I wish you had asked the price before you put that on, she said impatiently. We never can afford it.
It's not so much as you think, said Margaret. Don't you see what I did? I had them take off the quills, and put on some of those Phoebe Sims gave me from her peacocks. The hat will only cost you a dollar and a half. She avoided Wesley's eyes, and looked straight at Mrs. Comstock. Elnora removed the hat to examine it. Why, they are those reddish tan quills of yours. She cried. Mother, look how beautifully they are set on. I'd much rather have them than those from the store.
So would I, said Mrs. Comstock. If Margaret wants to spare them, that will make you a beautiful hat, dirt cheap, too. You must go past Mrs. Sims and show her. She would be pleased to see them.
Elnora sank into a chair and contemplated her toe. Lendy, ain't I a queen? She murmured. What else have I got? Just a belt, some handkerchiefs, and a pair of top shoes for rainy days and colder weather, said Margaret.
About those high shoes, that was my idea, said Wesley. Soon as it rains, low shoes won't do, and by taking two pairs at once I could get them some cheaper. The low ones are $2 and the high ones $2.50, together $3.75. Ain't that cheap?
That's a real bargain, said Mrs. Comstock, if they are good shoes, and they look it.
This, said Wesley, producing the last package, is your Christmas present from your Aunt Maggie.
I got mine, too, but it's at the house. I'll bring it up in the morning. He handed Margaret the umbrella, and she passed it over to Elnora, who opened it and sat laughing under its shelter. Then she kissed both of them. She brought a pencil and a slip of paper to set down the prices they gave her of everything they had brought except the umbrella, added the sum, and said laughingly, "Will you please wait till tomorrow for the money?"
"I will have it then, sure."
Elnora, said Wesley Sinton. Wouldn't you?
Elnora, hustle here a minute. Called Mrs. Comstock from the kitchen. I need you.
1 second, mother, answered Elnora, throwing off the coat and hat, and closing the umbrella as she ran. There were several errands to do in a hurry, and then supper. Elnora chattered incessantly, Wesley and Margaret talked all they could, while Mrs. Comstock said a word now and then, which was all she ever did. But Wesley Sinton was watching her. And time and again he saw a peculiar little twist around her mouth. He knew that for the first time in 16 years she really was laughing over something. She had all she could do to preserve her usually sober face. Wesley knew what she was thinking. After supper the dress was finished, the pattern for the next one discussed, and then the Sintons went home. Elnora gathered her treasures. When she started upstairs she stopped.
May I kiss you goodnight, mother? She asked lightly.
Never mind any slobbering, said Mrs. Comstock. I should think you'd lived with me long enough to know that I don't care for it.
Well, I'd love to show you in some way how happy I am, and how I thank you.
I wonder what for? Said Mrs. Comstock. Mag Sinton chose that stuff and brought it here and you pay for it.
Yes, but you seemed willing for me to have it, and you said you would help me if I couldn't pay all.
Maybe I did, said Mrs. Comstock. Maybe I did. I meant to get you some heavy dress skirts about Thanksgiving. And I still can get them. Go to bed, and for any sake don't begin mooning before a mirror, and make a dunce of yourself.
Mrs. Comstock picked up several papers and blew out the kitchen light. She stood in the middle of the sitting room floor for a time and then went into her room and closed the door. Sitting on the edge of the bed she thought for a few minutes and then suddenly buried her face in the pillow and again heaved with laughter. Down the road plodded Margaret and Wesley Sinton. Neither of them had words to utter their united thought.
Done. Hissed Wesley at last. Dun Brown. Did you ever feel like a bloomin', confounded donkey? How did the woman do it?
She didn't do it, gulped Margaret through her tears. She didn't do anything. She trusted to Elnora's great big soul to bring her out right, and really she was right, and so it had to bring her. She's a darling, Wesley. But she's got a time before her. Did you see Kate Comstock grab that money? Before 6 months she'll be out combing the Limberlost for bugs and arrow points to help pay the tax. I know her.
Well, I don't. Exclaimed Sinton, she's too many for me. But there is a laugh left in her yet. I didn't suppose there was. Bet you a dollar, if we could see her this minute, she'd be chuckling over the way we got left.
Both of them stopped in the road and looked back. There's Elnora's light in her room, said Margaret.
The poor child will feel those clothes, and pore over her books till morning, but she'll look decent to go to school, anyway. Nothing is too big a price to pay for that. Yes, if Kate lets her wear them. 10 to 1, she makes her finish the week with that old stuff.
No, she won't, said Margaret. She'll hardly dare. Kate made some concessions, all right, big ones for her if she did get her way in the main. She bent some, and if Elnora proves that she can walk out barehanded in the morning and come back with that much money in her pocket, an armful of books, and buy a turnout like that, she proves that she is of some consideration, and Kate's smart enough. She'll think twice before she'll do that. Elnora won't wear a calico dress to high school again. You watch and see if she does. She may have the best clothes she'll get for a time, for the least money, but she won't know it until she tries to buy goods herself at the same rates.
Wesley, what about those prices? Didn't they shrink considerable?
You began it, said Wesley. Those prices were all right. We didn't say what the goods cost us, we said what they would cost her. Surely, she's mistaken about being able to pay all that. Can she pick up stuff of that value around the Limberlost? Didn't the bird woman see her trouble, and just give her the money?
I don't think so, said Margaret. Seems to me I've heard of her paying, or offering to pay those who would take the money, for bugs and butterflies, and I've known people who sold that bank or Indian stuff. Once I heard that his pipe collection beat that of the government a